Make it right. Make it right. Yes, you're hearing a little bit of James Brown. You're hearing some Fela. You're hearing even the JB's bass man, Bootsy Collins, and his brother Catfish on guitar. Their sounds inspire the Soul Jazz Orchestra, who come from deep in the heart of Ottawa. Ottawa, Ontario. This is People People from the album Manifesto, released in 2008, featuring Pierre Chrétien on keyboards, Zachary France on saxophone, Ray Murray also on saxophone, and Steve Patterson on saxophone, and percussionists Marielle Riva and Philippe Lafreniere. All of them sing on this album. It's a really interesting sound because they combine all these musical genres into a fantastic rhythm, and their music is purposeful. The idea to, they call it militant Afrobeat, but really incredible music. I enjoy it quite a bit. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, January the 17th. And in a much-anticipated speech, the president just an hour ago formally responded to the furor over wholesale electronic spying by the National Security Agency at home and abroad, with a series of restraints, he says, will curb such activity, restore confidence in the prudent judgment of the government among citizens and U.S. allies, and increase legislative oversight and transparency. Sounds good. But he defended the purpose of the program, saying it is a necessary and critical component of America's arsenal against terrorism. And he appeared not to change his view that Edward Snowden, whose leaks sparked public outrage about the NSA, is criminally liable for releasing classified information. There's a lot to digest about his speech, a ton of things that we have to get to, so we can't do that today. But we close out the week discussing what you would like to do about CNN's outrageous coverage of Dennis Rodman and his team of basketball players who have been castigated for making a trip to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and in the case of Rodman specifically, declining on this trip to personally negotiate and press for the release of a Korean-American, Kenneth Bai, in prison there. But first, some good news to report out of Detroit. And for that, we have Abayomi Azikiwe with us. He's editor of the Pan-African Newswire, a Detroit organizer for the Workers' World Party, and organizer of Moratorium Now, a grassroots group that has been seeking to halt foreclosures, evictions, and utility cutoffs for struggling Detroiters until the predatory lending practices by banks are investigated and resolved. Abayomi, a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, my goodness. The pleasure actually is mine, and I'm very honored that you can join us today. Now, let's pick up from where we left off the last time we talked. Tell us about this good news.
Well, yes, this is the first significant legal victory in the entire anti-emergency manager and anti-bankruptcy struggle. It was preceded by two smaller victories. One back during December when this preliminary hearings were being carried out for this swap trial, where the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who was appointed by Governor Rick Snyder, who functions as a agent, really, of the banks and the financial institutions and the transnational corporations in the state capital, when he attempted to arrange this deal, they wanted to conceal the cost of the fees to Barclays Bank, which would have loaned Detroit some $280 million to pay off some bad credit deals through an interest rate swap from 2005, which was renewed in 2009. And Jerry Goldberg, who is an attorney here in the city of Detroit, representing a retiree, David Soule, who's a member of Moratorium Now and Stop the Theft of Our Pensions Committee, said, no, this is a violation of the Freedom of Information Act, even for the state of Michigan, let alone the federal government. These are public funds that we're discussing here. So the fees associated with the arrangement of this deal by Barclays Bank should be made public, and the judge agreed with that. So they had to reveal that Barclays was being paid $4.4 million just for the arrangement of this deal that would have terminated these interest rate swaps from UBS, United Bank of Switzerland, and Bank of America. And then the second took place on December the 18th when the trial was stopped. Judge Stephen Rose, the federal judge who's presiding over the bankruptcy, stopped the trial for these swaps, saying that the emergency manager had to go back and negotiate a better deal between the city and UBS and Bank of America to terminate these disastrous swap agreements. They came back with a deal on December 24th and 25th, and it was actually supervised by another federal judge, Rosen, who is the mediator in this case. And they came back. Our objections were heard on January 3rd. Jones Day, a multimillion-dollar law firm that's supposedly representing the city of Detroit under emergency management, provided their closing arguments. And then because of the inclement weather during the week of January the 6th, the trial was adjourned for another week until the 13th, when the objectors were able to conclude their arguments. And the judge said he would announce his decision on January the 16th, which he did. And promptly at 9 o'clock, he came out and read a rather lengthy opinion saying that he was going to turn down this deal and that, you know, the city has to stop getting involved in these disastrous financial arrangements. So they stopped Barclays, Bank of America, as well as UBS. We've already paid them $300 million in interest for these interest rate swaps. That was the rage of the day during the mid-2000s. These deals were being cut all over the United States, and that's why now we're having so many financial problems across the United States because of this type of financing, another form of predatory lending, but this time on a municipal level as opposed to a mortgage level.
Well, tell us how much money was actually being asked for. The settlement, the banks, these two banks were willing to take about $165 million, and the judge
yes.
says, go back, do some more thinking. It ain't going to happen. What has been the upshot since the judge's ruling? I know that was just yesterday?
It was just yesterday. It was read at, starting at 2 p.m. Yesterday afternoon, Eastern Standard Time. And it's been front page news. It's been the lead story on mainstream media. All of the financial publications are abuzz with this information because it sends a message to the financial institutions that have been snarled, municipalities all over the United States, and these type of credit default swaps and interest rate swap deals that have been disadvantageous to the cities. They've drained municipal finance. They've jeopardized pension systems in various cities and states throughout the United States. And I think here in Detroit, we've struck a chord because we're not the only city in the country that's facing such a financial crisis. In California, there have been several cities that have filed for bankruptcy, Stockton, San Bernardino, Vallejo, and others. We've seen what has happened in Jefferson County, Alabama, where Birmingham is located. We see what's going on in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Providence, Rhode Island, and other cities across the United States. But we've been fortunate enough to be able to pull together a grassroots coalition of people who want to oppose emergency management and this illegally imposed bankruptcy and the permanent indentured financial servitude to the banks and defining the banks as being the major source of the crisis, not only in Detroit, but in cities across the United States. So hopefully this ruling in terms of the post-eligibility bankruptcy situation can provide some legal impetus for other cities. And, of course, we're going into another phase, and that is the phase where the emergency manager has to put forward a plan of adjustment for the exiting of the city from bankruptcy. And this is where the negotiations will take place in terms of who will be paid what will be cut, what will be restructured. And we want to be involved in that entire process because it's important that the people of the city of Detroit, the union members, the public employees, the residents, the small business people, the retirees, all of them have to be involved in this debate, in this discussion, and in this struggle, because if we're not involved, the banks and their appointed agents in government will make decisions for us that are definitely not in our best interest.
Well, still, I mean, it has been a very long struggle. I know the Mr. Goldberg, I've listened to him conducting an examination and cross-examination of the financial wizards there who made this deal. It must come as at least a heartwarming reward for a long and protracted struggle to get this issue actually looked at in some way. And even if it occurs as part of the judge's determination about an illegally imposed bankruptcy, as you claim, and as it is, actually, then you still have to say, well, people power brought some degree of success so far in a critical area here.
I think the issues were so dramatic in terms of they have residents not only in Detroit but across the country, because if you look at a lot of these municipalities, a lot of them are speaking now in regard to underfunded pension systems, underfunded public transportation systems. And if we trace back the origins of these crises, we can see they lead to these type of creative financial arrangements that the cities have been attached to. And it's very unfortunate because, see, the municipal bond industry is a $3.7 trillion market right now. And there's crisis inside of the market because what's going on is wages are being lowered. People have lost their homes over the last 7 years at an unprecedented magnitude inside the United States. This drains public tax revenues. The decline in income, of course, people don't have as much money to spend, disposable income, as they once had. And this is a drain on the neighborhoods, on the small businesses, and even on the larger corporations, as quiet as it is kept. So these are the crises that the federal government refuses to address, that the corporate community refuses to address. They can't even pass a bill to extend unemployment benefits to people who have no prospects for any type of employment, and let alone viable employment. So this is the crisis we're facing. It's really a political crisis inside the United States, that we have a government, we have a corporate community that refuses systematically to address these fundamental issues, the decline of the cities, the decline in wages, the disruption in the housing market. We have a population that's now facing massive cuts in the pension systems. They already have plans to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. So it's really a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And if the government won't address it, if the corporate community won't address it, then the communities themselves, the trade unions, the community organizations, the youth groups, public intellectuals, these are the forces that have to come together to address these issues.
Well, it didn't seem to be ironic to a visitor that you had there yesterday that in the midst of all of this distress, this economic distress, and the bankruptcy of the imposed bankruptcy of Detroit, you had Vice President Joe Biden as a guest yesterday in your city celebrating the great comeback of Detroit. It was the host of the North American International Auto Show at Cobo Center in Detroit. And Vice President Biden was there saying, you know, see, things are working, things are bouncing back, and, you know, it's about cars. People came in, they saw the cars, and they left Detroit the same way they'd met it. Did it strike you as odd that, you know, in the face of this devastation, that the vice president, clearly just garnering ammunition for an intended run in 2016, that it, you know, this kind of PR should happen as a juxtaposition to the misery that surrounds Detroit.
Yes. And the comeback is for the 1%, for the owners of the auto industry and people they collaborate with in business. Yes, the banks, their profits, margins are doing quite well. I mean, the banks was a $3.4 billion in profit for Bank of America just in the last quarter of 2013. That's amazing. But the people have bailed them out, and they have withheld hundreds of billions of dollars from investment that could create jobs, that could create a better life for people in the communities. And the Obama administration, which Joe Biden represents, seems to be endorsing such an approach to economic policy. Now, this is the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty that was launched in 1964, which coincided with the Civil Rights Movement inside the United States and the anti-colonial struggle internationally. Today, there's really no discussion about poverty, period, let alone ameliorating poverty or eradicating poverty. It's just not a part of the American political lexicon. So I think this is a reflection of the crisis in and of itself, that they cannot even afford to address the contradictions within American society, that here, the city of Detroit was illegally put in bankruptcy, that the majority of the people here are African-American, most of whom who are political, who are registered to vote, vote Democratic, and yet we have a Democratic administration that's been in the White House now. This is their second term, and they have not effectively addressed the crisis in Detroit. And it's just a very unfortunate situation, a set of political circumstances that we face here in the United States. Now, in this being an election year, you know, a off-season election year, by-elections, the governor is going to have to stand for re-election this year, and others as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens during the primaries and during the elections and the degree of enthusiasm that people may have in Detroit towards electoral politics, considering that many of the politicians have really have not intervened in this whole economic crisis, the bankruptcy, the whole struggle against emergency management at all.
Well, I thought it was even more symbolic, considering that it was the Obama administration that bailed out General Motors and actually took a $10.5 billion loss on that. It's also interesting that it bailed out Chrysler, which has been purchased by Fiat. So basically what the United States did was finance foreign ownership of an American company, and it also took a loss. So in the middle of all of that, here is the Vice President of the United States keeping the illusion that the, you know, with this international car show being held in Detroit, that the automobile sector is really alive and well. It was so, to me, it was so mind-boggling, the allegory being painted here, the PR, you know, being capitalized on, that the administration is somehow responsible for getting the automobile industry as vibrant as it is now, when in fact they took multi-billion dollar losses. And the quote by Biden was, I think he said something, let me see, I wrote it down. He says to the chairman of Ford, he says, "Thank you for saving our ass." That was his direct quote, in a quip that he made as he toured the show, to say that somehow the auto industry has just revitalized the city. And it was a stark contrast, and I think a big insult, to come to Detroit with all the splendor of this international auto show, people just showing up for the show, the get in and get out kind of thing, and the illusion that the show somehow is supposed to communicate a vibrant sector that, in fact, is no longer maintaining a major presence in Detroit, that, in fact, has been subsidized, and to the tune of billions and billions of dollars in losses. And in one case, as I said, in the case of Chrysler, to finance, essentially, Fiat's takeover of Chrysler. You know, how do you explain this? And yet there's no money to revitalize the city. There's no money to say, let's build up the infrastructure, let's, you know, take care of the essentials, the schools, the sanitation, and so forth. They can do this, and it's really a huge show. I want to ask you about Governor Snyder's State of the State address yesterday. Was anything said that seemed to suggest that he has had a change of heart, his lackluster support for anything going on in Detroit?
No, but the first point you made I thought was very significant about the auto industry, because what they don't say is that they set up a two-tier and a three-tier wage structure in the auto industry now. The senior employees make approximately twice as much as the new hires make, and some make even less than that. In the industry, they have a lot of subsidiary firms that do small parts and other types of production in the industry, which they promote themselves as not being necessarily affiliated with the major auto producers, but in fact, they produce to supply parts to Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors. The problem with the bailout and the restructuring of Chrysler and General Motors is that they lost tens of thousands of workers, and this process had been going on since the mid-1980s, even before that, in terms of the loss of auto production, the real jobs within the auto industry. For example, American Axle, is a large parts plant which had been affiliated with General Motors and produced parts for General Motors. They had one of the most militant unions in the country, UAW Local 235. And, you know, they just got, at one point, told them if they kept making demands on the company that they would close down the firm. And they did do that and moved it to Mexico. And also, they never talk about the dealerships, where, you know, hundreds of dealerships were closed in the whole restructuring process. The salespeople lost their jobs. The mechanics who worked, who were unionized, lost their jobs. Clerical workers lost their jobs. And now, with this low-wage economy and low-wage corporate policy, this is what workers are facing right now in the United States. They have been hiring people in the Detroit area, but people are being hired at half the salary that the senior employees are working for. And some are even less than that. I've known people to get hired at $11 an hour to work 7 days a week and 12 hours a day making auto parts, which are supplied to the larger auto producers. So this is what's going on right now. And I think Governor Snyder's State of the State address last night was he's positioning himself to run again for the office in November. So he has to make it appear that, you know, Michigan is back, that there's a billion-dollar budget surplus. What he doesn't say is that they've cut taxes for businesses. They've eliminated the earned income credit, state earned income credit for low-income people. They've eliminated $1 billion out of the education fund. They've slashed social services to women and children who otherwise, you know, have no income. So, yes, this is where they get the $971 million surplus from. It has nothing to do with the viability or the effectiveness of their policies.
So, as we wrap up, what's the immediate plan of action now, especially in the court? What's going to happen there?
Well, the next phase is going to deal with the issue of fairness and equity in the bankruptcy process, and it's going to be very important because this is where the emergency manager and the banks and the bond insurers are going to push for the slashing of pensions and health care benefits for retirees, the selling off of city assets. They have a scheme right now to transfer the control of the art at the Detroit Institute of Arts to a trust under the guise that these charitable organizations are going to be providing over $300 million in assistance for the city and the so-called assistance for the pensioners as well. None of this has been spelled out specifically. The state is claiming it's going to match their $300+ million, but none of this has been spelled out in detail. And when I did read in one of the corporate newspapers that they were going to, in fact, transfer control and consequently ownership of the artwork to another entity, which they had been calling a trust during the first day of this announcement, is something that looks very, very suspicious. All of the artwork at the DIA belongs to the people of the city of Detroit and should stay that way. It should not, the ownership should not be transferred to a private trust. And they've already done an appraisal, Christie's, claiming that it was in excess of $800 million worth of art there. So these are some of the issues that we're going to be focusing on. Also, we want no cuts in the pensions and the health care benefits of retirees, no selling of city assets, no further privatization of city departments and city services. And this is where the struggle is going to go at this point. The judge did say in his ruling that the Jones Day, which is illegally representing the city of Detroit now, should take legal action against Bank of America and UBS and Merrill Lynch to try to dispose of this illegal swap deal, which may have violated the State Gaming Act and other laws in the state of Michigan in 2005 as well as 2009. Also, he said that he wanted to scrutinize whatever loans they got to make sure that they go for city services and that they cannot just say that they want to borrow money for the purpose of working capital, which is really a code word to pay consultants. They're paying people right now millions upon millions of dollars, essentially for doing nothing in the city. These people who don't live in the city, who know nothing about municipal government, they've been put in charge of departments and divisions in the city of Detroit. And that's why there's so much chaos that's going on downtown now. That's why the public transportation system is in a mess, because you have people who have been appointed for political reasons, who have no experience in running a city, to, in fact, attempt to run a city. So, you know, these things need to be addressed within the entire bankruptcy process and also outside of it.
If you can, I forgot, I don't know how I did that, but I wanted to ask you if you can quickly give us an idea of the newly elected mayor. Where does he sit in all of this, since he can't make many decisions because of the bankruptcy proceedings? How is he managing? What is he doing?
Well, my view is that he's part of the entire process. Last night he was sitting in the front row when Governor Snyder was giving a State of the State address in Lansing. So that is a clear signal that he's part of this entire emergency management forced illegal bankruptcy process. And he has no history of any type of progressive politics in this region. He was the CEO at the Detroit Medical Center. When he went in, it was a nonprofit corporation owned by the city of Detroit. When he left, it had been privatized and sold to a multinational corporation. So this is his history. He prevented the Michigan Nurses Association from gaining labor recognition while he was at the Detroit Medical Center. So he's not a friend of the unions, and he's not a friend of working people. He's not from Detroit. He lives in Livonia. And there was a question about even his candidacy, which had been challenged because he had not been a resident long enough in order to run for mayor. But the 1% wanted him bad enough that they even gave him over $3 million to install him in office for a job that pays approximately $200,000 a year. So you know something must be going on.
It always is. Thank you so much, Abayomi. This has been extraordinarily informational and very helpful to get us up to snuff on what's been happening with Detroit. And certainly, we could not ignore the fact that all these things coincided yesterday. Biden's visit,
yes,
the state of the state address, and the judge's ruling. So yesterday was a
yes,
big day. So we'll be talking again soon as events warrant. But thank you so much for being with us today and for being so extraordinarily informative.
Thank you again.
All right. Bye-bye. Well, we'll come back. And when we come back, we're going to be talking business about what it is you want to do about CNN. Your views at 888-874-4888. Let's hear a little bit more from the Soul Jazz Orchestra while you make up your mind. Seven four four eight eight eight. What is it that you want to do? Let's hear it. Sarah, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Oh,
and by the way,
you.
I have to say this. I just want to let you know I'm getting a little bit insecure here because far too many people are writing me saying, say hello to Sarah. I don't understand what this is, but I'm insecure about it.
Well, I do apologize for that, Matrice, and whoever you all are, please do not do that to you, Matrice. Please show the host the courtesy.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying it's amazing how, you know, what I'm saying is that people are identifying with each other like family members, you know what I mean? It's really, really great. You're on the air, Sarah.
Yes, ma'am. Utrice, by the way, and the PRN audience and Gary and all of the other hosts on the network, y'all have been doing a fantastic job. As I said, I've been sending out email blasts to let everyone know about this network so that they can start tuning in. And that's one of the things that we can do with the CNN piece that you were speaking of and what's going on with them. We've got to find other alternative sources of getting information. It's like after you came off yesterday and I happened to listen to Mike Feder and Jack Rasmus that came on after you and all of these other hosts, you get so much information, especially on the financial sectors and all of these other things that's going on in this country, things that you are not going to get in corporate media where they bury that information. So what we need to do, people who still have cable, who are still tied to these networks, you need to start writing your cable provider and let them know that you are dissatisfied, especially CNN. You need to let the new president know. You need, because as the other people say, Utrice, if you're writing on blogs and the minute that you came off their blogs and you comment, they're censoring it, they're deleting those comments, it tells you that they know what they're doing is incorrect. That's why they are monitoring these sites and they're deleting negative comments. So you need to find other way of getting up there to them, either a change.org petition or whatever it is that we might need to do. We need to let these people know because this type of journalism that they're doing, this hatchet job, as you said, it is not going to cut it. And people need to stop boycotting them. Whoever gets invited to come onto these networks, especially like what it did to these athletes, and then, of course, they always have to call out, send out bulletins to get other black athletes to come on and bash each other. We need to have some kind of code of conduct and says, you know what? No, thank you. I'm going to pass on it. I don't have any opinion to say on this. We need to start standing up and acting like men and women and stop kowtowing and behaving like children.
Well, thank you. Thanks for that.
You're welcome, Yatrice.
DX from LA, what are your thoughts?
Hello, Yatrice. How
Hello.
Are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I wanted to first make another observation that I didn't initially hear when you played those clips. Just make it real quick, and then I'll say what we should do. The statement that one of those reporters, the question they asked, do you feel like Dennis Rodman suckered you into this? I thought about that, mm-hmm. and I mm-hmm. said, you know, that's that divide and conquer strategy as well that's going on there, you know? So I thought there
well,
was
actually, let me just tell you late. What that is, if I could right away, so it doesn't get lost. Mm-hmm. That is a way of planting a headline.
Right.
Now, it's actually, he doesn't care what the answer is.
Right.
He cares sure only that the headline has been given. In other words, he's saying to the guest, you are a sucker. No matter how the guest answers, that's the opinion of the host, okay?
Right,
so that's a technique
exactly.
that they use to say.
It's
know,
a way of just putting it out there. Like you know, like.
Pierce Morgan kept saying.
You guys can't even stick together. He betrayed this guy here, and he's too dumb to see it. So something like that. You know what I mean? So I thought that was kind of interesting. It just hit me later. What I think we should do about it, I think we should troll them. And what that means is what people don't know is like we all send out email bombs to their emails or to their sites, maybe with some kind of exclusive that they might want to pick up on. You know, everybody picks something and have thousands of people just crash their website. I think we should do that.
Ooh, is that legal? That's not legal.
Yeah, it's legal. You can do that. Sure you can.
Let's talk about how within we have to maintain some degree of standards. I mean, we don't want to sink to their standards. Let's keep some higher standards.
No, but
that
would serve them right, though, for doing that. You know, because you know, let's give them a bunch of fake leads to follow up on. Keep them busy. How about that?
But it still brings you down to the level where they are.
Well,
the idea is you have
we have to fight fire with fire, though. I mean,
okay. Well, I'm not going to change your mind. So, but you know, but the thing is, I'm saying we have a serious issue here, and the issue is to. By the way, somebody sent me some information yesterday that was printed in the New York Post. Let me get it. It was amazing. The New York Post article shows that they're really tanking. CNN is going down fast.
I think we should help them.
The ratings are at an all-time low, and especially for those shows that are appearing in these particular primetime spots, and they don't know quite what to do about it. So this is my point. In this desperation, CNN is going to try anything possible, including being sensational. They don't want to be all the way sensational because, after all, they are a news organization, you understand. So there are certain things they have to not do. But what they can do always, when media organizations reach this point, they do the natural thing, which is to find somebody who is powerless and beat them all up. So.
Oh, yes. But I think you should reconsider and think about doing what I say. I'll help you coordinate the effort. We'll just
I wouldn't do it. I mean, I would not conduct a campaign like that against CNN because it really is – it's a waste of time in the end. What it does is that it brings you down to a level you don't want to be operating there. What you want to do is to, you know, you have a principled fight, keep it principled. You know what
I
mean?
One day I'm going to convince you, though. I'm going to convince you.
All right. Thanks,
have a great day, you chief.
Thank you so much. Well, there is a suggestion from let me try and locate it. I'm just so hopeless about these things. I can't manage media too well. I really can't. But the proposal has come from a listener, Laura. who says that this is what she proposes. She says she sent a letter to CNN. Of course, it went up, but it just disappeared. But what she wants is for people to start a petition of some sort, and then build on that petition. You know, she said there's a site. Please go on the Facebook page, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. You'll see her proposal there. Her proposal is to start a petition, a formal petition, citing the acts of commission committed by CNN with respect to the coverage of this event and the principles involved, and to register, absolutely register, our outrage, our collective outrage about it, and what your thoughts might be about that. You see it on the Facebook page. It would be very helpful if you can read it and just also react so we know where we're going. The reason I'm doing this is I think, you know, it's a very good thing to talk these things out. What is it that you want to do? We talk all the time about people who talk but don't do. And part of what it is we have to do, especially in a situation that we can do something about, it is within our ability to do something about it, we certainly can do it. But what it is that we will do, we have to discuss, we have to decide. And that is a process of talking. 888-874-4888. I'm trying to locate that page. I'm just really not doing very well. You know what I need? I need my 7-year-old nephew here to come and show this geezer how to get this thing together. Here's the thing. What then is our commitment? We don't know Dennis Rodman. We don't know any of these players, and that is not the point. The point is that we should stand for some kind of principled way of operating. We should not, having clearly seen the dichotomy in the coverage of, let's say, the New York Philharmonic, as opposed to the way they covered these athletes, what is the answer for that? What is the reason for the dichotomy of coverage? And we have to hold CNN accountable, it seems to me, because they have the wherewithal to decide what is news. They have the wherewithal to decide what professional standards are. They have internal mechanisms that should have rung so many bells to them to say, you know, they're off base. And they really, you know, that interview did not go well. It didn't seem like any of those controls were working. In fact, it seemed as if a decision had been made at the editorial level, at the decision-making level, let's just carve these guys up in every possible program where we can present the CNN point of view, whether it's CNN Sports or the morning program or Piers Morgan or some other venue within the CNN lineup. We will hand each host the opportunity to carry out the basic campaign. And that's the way they do it. And we saw also the actual glee. I mean, they were really happy to do the job. It was disturbing to see African Americans, to see the zeal that they had for just you know, the carnage. And I say that because something should have gone on in their heads to say, well, wait a minute, this isn't right. They seem to be repeating the same buzzwords, you know, you're working for a despot, you're friendly with a dictator. How could you explain this and how could you explain that? I'm seeing this pattern pervasively in the media. So the question is, if they can do that to anybody, they will do it to everybody. And with everything being what it is, we can't deny the fact that this was completely unwarranted. It just was not the right way to do. And they should be ashamed of themselves, plain and simple, especially since they hold themselves above others within the media world as being a Okay. Well, that was a glitch. That was me. I caused it. Did you lose a lot? Okay. I muted myself. I tell you, you can't have me around a computer. You really can't. If I'm good, I'm good just typing what it is I need to type, but everything else, it's argument. It's an argument. Mike from Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, I don't watch CNN, but do they have sponsors that sponsor that show?
Oh, yeah, they have advertisers all the way.
And then we should go after them and maybe contact them and tell them our disapproval. You know, this is racism to the highest.
Well, I don't
think the sponsors would want anything to do with this.
All right, well, you've put that up, and let's see how people react. Shelby
okay.
from Louisiana, thank you for calling.
Hey, how's it going, Sister Yatrita? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I agree with the previous caller that we should go after their sponsors. So I'd be the first one in line to boycott their sponsors and contact their sponsors and let them know the points that we're making. Now, you know, Sister Latrice, I was listening to Malcolm X's message to the grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I guess it's 39 years ago or 40 years ago, Malcolm X was raising the same point. And Malcolm was saying that if violence is wrong in America, then violence is wrong abroad. He was pointing out that same contradiction, that the white people in this country, they didn't want black people to use to defend themselves, and they would call that violence. But they would go abroad and do the violence thing. So the same issue that you're raising about this contradiction, Malcolm X was raising that contradiction about 40 years ago. So we're still dealing with the same thing. It almost seems as though whenever we address a point, the white supremacy thing, they change, they morph. Dr. Clark was saying the same thing.
But you know, Shelby, here's the thing. This really speaks to corporate behavior. And corporate behavior, which is, of course, very much in line with what you're talking about, because they are, in fact, extensions of the government in many ways. They seem to be serving that purpose. We can see the clear connection here between CNN's coverage and the tacit views, although the Obama administration was not openly hostile about it. But you can see that there is a connection between the sentiments in the broader sense and the signals sent to CNN. You have our permission to do this. And
I agree with that now. There's levels to this, Sister Latrice. I think at some point they will try to ignore us, and if
sure.
If it gets so bad, if we stink up the party so bad, and if they refuse to ignore us anymore, then they will send out some of the little gatekeepers. They'll send out the gatekeepers to block us.
Well, your point is well taken, and so
okay,
your suggestion.
But thanks for taking my call. I want to listen to some other callers. But I'm with the boycott. Whatever we want to do for their whoever's funding them, we can block them.
All righty. Thank you very much, Shelby, for your call. A couple of suggestions are in the pot. We will react to them. Please register your views in one of two ways. You can also do so on air here, although our time is limited. But on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. And, of course, you can always write me on my email at leadstories@gmail.com. So we will keep this conversation going because there's so much I'm getting, so many reactions I'm getting from people who feel a sense that they need to do something. It's one thing to feel a particular way about this, but now to actualize those feelings and to share them. So I would recommend on the Facebook page, if you can, because it's more public there. People can go and see what other people are thinking. Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead on Facebook would be a really good way to register your views. Well, we're coming close to the end of the program today. I'm sorry that I deprived my connection, myself a connection with you by unwittingly muting myself. But we have so many things to talk about, and we'll get to that. On Monday, of course, is Martin Luther King Day, a very special program intended for you, very incisive thoughts from Dr. King, not generally shared, not generally known, and it moved me. It's a very important thing to contemplate what it is he had to say. I hope the information from Detroit kept us in the loop. We are witnessing the template being set in Detroit. It was really good to hear that this struggle by people, regular, ordinary people, insisting that these are banksters who have driven not only the city, the municipality, that is, but the people in the city. There are so many foreclosures in Detroit as a result of these usurious lending rates, predatory lending by these very banks. And so it serves notice that struggle does yield results. It's not always a futile effort. You know, it does, in some cases, bring about very important change. And don't underestimate the power of organizing. Remember, Martin Luther King was at first a mobilizer. He was the guy to get the crowds out, to get them to show up and to get them to do whatever it is they wanted to do, to just be there, to show up en masse and to sign on. It was a whole other thing now to take it to another level, which is to organize, from mobilizing to organizing. And that's what delivered a victory for the grassroots people in Detroit just yesterday. When this judge made the ruling, he, of course, has sent many other strange signals, but for this one, you have to take it as you get it. This was a victory yesterday, and again, it has implications beyond the geographic boundaries of Detroit. I want to thank you so much for joining me today and for participating. Please do send me your thoughts. We will share them again, and we will be back here on Monday. Thank you very much. Each of you, if you can pass the word on about PRN.FM and this, your very, very favorite program on PRN.FM, I would be so grateful. Let's build this organization. Let's build the capacity of PRN to serve more and more people, but they'll have to know that we exist, and they could come here and be part of this family. So thanks again. Stay right here, because coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thank you for the pleasure and the privilege of your company. I really mean that. Have yourselves a good weekend.